Welcome to a Wednesday edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I'm joined by Danny LaRue, and we are about to do a long, long overdue mailbag powered by my newly established Facebook page. So for those who don't know, Nate Duncan NBA is the Facebook link, same as my Twitter. You can ask questions on there, and I will try to answer them either by writing back when I have time or actually answering them on the air. So, Danny, are you excited for this first round of Facebook questions?
Yeah, the response was great. I was very impressed with it. Your page is doing well, but we got so not only good, like, a lot of volume, but questions that I looked at and was thought about, oh, that I got excited to answer them. So that's always what you're looking for in this sort of a setting.
Yeah, so, and for future mailbags, which we will probably get to a few of here over the next couple of weeks as we're kind of in this down period, and I really enjoy having those questions, like you said, to get a chance to kind of focus my own intellectual inquiries at this time when I don't necessarily have anything that's super pressing. So, it's really good. But the one thing is try to limit it to maybe three lines or so we can read the whole question on the air pretty simply. And all right, let's go. Let's start with some news, though. Not quite that much since we're in the dead period. The biggest thing that's come down, although this we haven't heard that this is actually going to happen yet. Jonas Valanciunas, as reported by Mark Stein, closing in on an extension with the Raptors that is going to be 4 years and in excess of $60 million. That usually means barely in excess of $60 million when you see that kind of reporting. And he is actually returned from training with the Lithuanian national team to Toronto to finalize it and get a physical. So I think we can assume that's probably going to happen. Doesn't always, as we've seen with another newsworthy guy, Tristan Thompson. But what are your preliminary thoughts on that deal if it does indeed occur, Danny?
If it's in that $60 million range, I think it's a great deal for Toronto. And you and I have talked before about how there's a group of guys, we talked about this in the 2016 podcast, where you only sign them if it's a really good deal for you, if you're the team, because of the flexibility. And getting Valanciunas at that number maintains Toronto's status as a player in free agency in 2016. So if they can do that, that's great for them. For Valanciunas, it's a lot of money. I mean, I'm never going to shake my head at $60 million. But it feels like, considering the ridiculous amount of teams that are going to have money, that somebody would have given it to him. I mean, that's less money comparative to the cap than Enes Kanter got. And I would say, even with his flaws, I would rather have Valanciunas than Kanter pretty clearly.
I agree with that because he's got a lot more length. And I think just generally doesn't have quite the warts that Kanter has as far as not really getting along with his teammates that well in Utah, being kind of controversial. I mean, you saw how Utah took off as soon as he was traded, and I think part of that was just having him out of that atmosphere. So, yeah, I agree with you. Now, did he want to have to languish potentially as a restricted free agent next year? Was he worried about getting hurt? All of that, those are legitimate concerns, of course, but I do think that the odds are he would have gotten maxed out next year, as we talked about on the 2016 podcast. But for Toronto, if you're going to sign him to maybe, you know, because his maximum would be about $21 million, if you're going to sign him to like $19 million, $18 million a year or something like that, your incentive is not to, because as you said, then that's going to increase the amount that he takes up next year and could be the difference between your being able to fit in another solid starter in free agency or even potentially, if they dump some salary, get into the Durant sweepstakes. But now this is enough of a discount that A, it's worth it to get him under, even if there is some opportunity cost for next year. But more importantly, there isn't much opportunity cost for next year because his cap hold was going to be about 11.8. And if he does the maximum 7.5% annual raises on that 4-year, $60 million deal, he could start in the mid 13. So you're really costing yourself less than $2 million in cap space next year. And to lock up a guy like that at basically what's going to be average starter money going forward, $15 million a year, very good for Toronto.
Yeah, and Valanciunas, sometimes with non-American players, people get a little bit tied up in terms of how old they are, you know, because they can come into the league at different ages. You can think about somebody like Nikola Mirotic. But Valanciunas, yeah, he's 23 right now, and he'll be 23 at the end of the regular season next year. So this will be an entire age 23 season for him. So that's, you're getting a lot of value because with the expectation of when a guy's prime is going to be, you're going to get right into the early part of his prime, in all likelihood, at a very good price. So the expectation has to be that he will be meaningfully better 2 years from now than he is now.
Yeah, and let's be clear, certainly his traditional box score statistics have overstated what he's been able to do. He definitely has been their third best big man. He's been really able to be effective scoring on post-ups. In pick and roll a little bit, he's got a nice mid-range jumper, but probably not something that projects to ever get out to the three-point line. But defensively, he has not been good enough, and that's why they usually end up closing with Amir Johnson at center these last 2 years. So, I mean, he's had like a 20 PR, which is great, but the on-off numbers have never been particularly favorable to him. However, what separates him again from someone like Cantor is I think he has the physical tools. He's got a lot of length. He's a true seven-footer. He's got enough heft that he's not going to get taken advantage of on the boards or on post-ups. And he definitely works hard on his verticality. I mean, when they visited Golden State, that's all that they were working on in pregame. And if he can kind of get those concepts, and most young bigs just aren't that good, he's only 23 still, over these next couple of years, you can at least construct a path as to how he could become a very good defensive player because of his tools and because he's a pretty hard worker. Not guaranteed to happen. Some guys just never get it from a mental perspective, but it's possible for him.
And with a guy at that price, you can pay that money for possibility, even if it's not, even if it's, if it was more likely than that, you wouldn't be getting him at that price.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think this is just yet another instance of really how players value certainty over another $20 million or so. I mean, that's really what he'd be, what he's giving up here is probably, you know, a 4 year, $80 million deal is what he might be able to get in free agency. So with that being the case, I think he's giving up money, but in the grand scheme of things, is $60 million really going to make you that much less happy than $80 million is? Probably not.
And we can transition from a player who appears to be more in line with patience to a guy who is apparently willing to handle a lot of risk, and that's the reporting around Tristan Thompson.
Yeah, Thompson is... Rich Paul is dipped into the usual agent playbook saber-rattling now, saying, A, that he is going to – he's not saying he won't be a Cavalier the year after next, but what he's claiming supposedly is that if he is forced to take the qualifying offer, that he will leave as an unrestricted free agent. Even then, I think that is more posturing because the Cavs can still offer him more years and more money than anyone else can, even as an unrestricted free agent. Now, he might want to go somewhere where he can start because he's probably never going to start in Cleveland with Mozgov and Love there. Maybe if Mozgov were to leave as a free agent next year, Thompson could then become basically the starting center. But you wrote a piece about this for the Sporting News saying that he should go elsewhere, get maxed out, look for an offer sheet. But Portland is really the only place left to do that. And I think one of the downsides to that in some of the conversations that I've had with people is they don't think he's that good. And maybe, you know, maybe that was a troll move on Oklahoma City to sign Cantor by Portland. But maybe they just don't think that Thompson is that good, or they like some of the guys that they have there already better than him. So what do you think of that argument, Danny, that if we just looked at what Thompson did last regular season, you would be laughing at this sort of max posturing. He really only came into his own during the playoffs when he did play very well and he did play starters minutes. But is it possible that everyone is overrating what he did in the playoffs?
It's certainly possible that people are overrating it, but
I think I might have been, frankly.
Yeah, but there's a very big gulf between overrating that and not being worth a 2+1 max. Because a 2+1 max this year, so that means 2 years and a player option, is so little risk for Portland, assuming Cleveland didn't match it. And like, if at that point, you could, if you wanted to, if you didn't think he was good enough for that, I think he would clearly be an asset to some teams at that price. So if you don't love him, then you trade him for somebody else at the deadline or something, and you do something with that. And if it works out, awesome. And yeah, it is true that he overlaps with guys like Ed Davis, and I guess that matters, even though Portland's not going to be relevant for the playoff picture. But I think he is their best chance at it. And the other, like, just to me, mind-numbing point on this is that Cleveland's going to match it. So what you're doing is you're basically buying up goodwill with Rich Paul, which is always a good thing. You know, he's becoming more powerful than he was. Cleveland's going to match it. I think the reason something like that hasn't happened yet is because I don't know that Tristan and his team really want that. I think what they want is a longer-term commitment from the Cavs, but that is a different thing. And if I were Portland, I would be much more comfortable with Tristan because of his risk offering 2 years in a player option than 3 years in a player option like they gave Kanter, even though I would prefer Thompson to Kanter.
Yeah, I think that you make a reasonable point there that he maybe doesn't want that, especially because he's going to be coming off the bench these next 2 years, 3 years, very likely. So, but if you really think of him as a center, the thing that I looked at, Kevin Pelton did a piece about this, about, you know, he's kind of worth more to Cleveland than he is to everyone else, is that he really did not protect the rim very well last year. Now, I thought he did much better at that in the playoffs, although a large part of that was against a Chicago team that had a bunch of guys who were really bad at finishing at the rim, that's kind of what was powering that observation. But I still think, yeah, he could be a starter. I think he might be a little bit overpaid on that contract. Again, though, there's really more money to go around than there are players over these next few years. But I do think it is important to really look back at his regular season and maybe slow down a little bit. Now, you know, he did contribute to some very good Cavaliers defensive performances, his ability to switch out. He was really fantastic against the Hawks in making the Hawks try to go one-on-one against Cleveland, which they really just weren't able to do. That defensive performance was the key to that series early on before all the Hawks guys got hurt. So, yeah, I think he's good, but maybe just talking about him as a fait accompli max guy might be a little far.
And that's exactly why you run a risk if you're him of taking the qualifying offer, because I don't think he's a new max guy with the way he's played at all. Like I think that his range is about where he is, which is the other reason why if I were his agent, I would be encouraging him to do something like what the Blazers could conceptually offer, unless the Cavs are going to pony up something big, because Your opportunity benefit, because you think about opportunity cost, but your benefit in this case isn't as high. This isn't a situation like Kawhi Leonard or Jimmy Butler theoretically taking their qualifying offer and pushing into the new max. Tristan is taking a $10 million hit based on, like, if theoretically he could get his max or close to it, and the benefit is getting into free agency. It's not really the money part of it, because he's not going to make back that money.
Unlike those guys, as you said, this is probably, both in terms of how he played on a big stage in the playoffs as a starter and the amount of leverage he has over the team with no way to replace him, kind of just the absolute peak of what his value might be. And I think capitalizing on that, even if it's not a max, is ultimately where he wants to be. Now, there's been discussion from my former colleague Steve Kyler at Basketball Insiders that he was offered 5 for $80 early on, which is reported as being pretty much done, if you'll remember, on basically the first day of free agency. But then he was not satisfied with that. He felt like other comparable players, we can debate whether they're comparable or not, got more than that. And so that's kind of what he's holding out for. But I think 5 for $80 is pretty darn good from his perspective. But we'll see what happens. I mean, his qualifying offer is pretty big. It's $6.8 million since he was the number 4 pick. So that's not as much of a sacrifice as it would have been for some of these other guys. I predict it'll ultimately get done for like $84 million or something like that. But we'll see. It'll be interesting how far they push it.
Quick random question. How would you conceptually like his fit next to Valanciunas if Toronto offered him some of their space next year?
Terrible. I mean, he's a center. He's a center. Like, he has to play center. And the reason I never liked him and the reason I came around on him a little bit during the playoffs was his ability to switch out. And I thought, at least, his ability to protect the rim a little bit better than he had been. And but just his lack of shooting range means that on offense, he has to be a center. You can't play him with another guy who can't shoot. He was okay with Mozgov playing together, but that's because they were doing that kind of LeBron iso ball. You put that on another team, and it's really going to be trouble. So, yeah, I think he is a center, and while starting centers can probably make are worth close to what the max is right now, going forward at least when the cap goes up, yeah, I'm not quite sure that he's in the upper half of starting centers in the league, even with the ability to switch, which a lot of centers don't have.
Yep, I think that's totally fair.
All right. Yeah, whenever we go on these contracts, we get going for so long. Let's blow through another few of these. China gets the 2019 World Cup. That's going to be very interesting in a number of respects. One is that I think more stars are going to play in the World Cup because it's China, because of the marketing opportunities. And also, it's 1 year before the Olympics. David Stern had talked about maybe making the Olympics kind of like it is in soccer, you know, a 23 and under tournament. I think there are more options for the NBA to get money out of the World Cup going forward, so they may want to start emphasizing that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the World Cup, because they're now switching it to be just 1 year before the Olympics, so it doesn't compete with the soccer World Cup.
Yeah, I'm excited about that development. I mean, I'm granted not, of course, that level, but I've always thought that a gold medal is just a really impressive thing. But for the NBA as a financial reality, it is true that they could get a much bigger piece of that pie. They could do some other things there. And I think that's a good idea. You know, if you can do that, if you can build something out, especially in a sport that doesn't have national cups and things like that, which European soccer does, which I think is a model that the U.S. could emulate to certain degrees. And so the FIBA idea gets a little bit closer to that while maintaining the financial incentives that they just can't get with the Olympics. The Olympics is more about, you know, the sponsors, more people like Nike, but the NBA is limited in that sense. So yeah, I think that makes sense. And China is a logical place to have that maybe launch point for the new paradigm.
Speaking of sponsors, we would like to tell you about SeatGeek. This is now the third show that they've sponsored on a preliminary basis, and we hope that that will become permanent. But for that to happen, you're going to have to go there and sign up with SeatGeek, which you should absolutely do. SeatGeek is the best way to get tickets. It basically aggregates all of the normal ticket sites. You get a lot of anxiety. You got to go through StubHub. You got to go through the official site. You have to go through all these different sites, other ticket brokers, to try and determine what the best deal is. Now you don't have to do that anymore. It's all on one site, just like Kayak, but for concert and sports tickets. And they have a very analytical approach. They offer a product called Deal Score that shows you whether a deal is good or bad. Great maps of the arena so you know exactly where your seat is going to be. And most of all, they really liked the podcast. They started sponsoring it because the people who work there really liked it. So you can use our code CAPSPACE, that's all one word, CAPSPACE, and you get $20 off of your first purchase. It also lets them know that you came from us, which is a good reason for them to keep sponsoring us. So please go and check that out, and you know, also hit up their Twitter account. Let them know that you came from us. That's cool, too. So that's SeatGeek. Download the app or go online and check them out. All right, so we got a little bit more news now. Jarrell Arthur is back to the Nuggets. Small deal for 1 year plus a player option. Was it ever actually reported how much that is?
I think it was like $3 million is what's in my head. It was something around the room exception.
Okay. Yeah, I think they would have just used his used his work rights.
Yeah, but I think the number, yeah, I have the first year is about 2.8. So that's room exception level.
Another interesting note, Arne Kander, longtime Detroit Pistons trainer, is now joining the Timberwolves. He had a great record of keeping guys healthy throughout most of his tenure with the Pistons, especially back when, if you think about when it was Ben Wallace and Rasheed Wallace and Hamilton, that great starting five, Billups, Prince, those guys all stayed incredibly healthy, and he had a big part in that. The Wolves are probably the team that could most benefit from his ministrations because they have a ton of guys injured every year, so I think that could be a big hire for them to keep going. Another non-player hire, Roland Beach, the Mavs statistical consultant, started 82games.com, a real pioneer in on-off data, and the consultant for the Mavs who's credited with helping to put Jose Barea in the starting lineup in 2011, which is a big for them in shifting that series against the Heat. He is now joining the Kings. That's a real good hire. So really another titan of basketball analytics joining there after Dean Oliver left. So good hire for the Kings. We always are killing them, so we had to say that. What else we got?
So JaVale McGee signed with the Mavericks. Looks like a small guarantee. I think he's a high upside guy, but the Mavericks are a team with a crazy situation because they have so many guys under contract, a lot of them on heavy guarantees. And so a lot of the lesser guaranteed guys, you know, the Brandon Ashleys of the world, the expectation is that they won't make it, but they're putting flyers on them. But between players like Villanueva and D'Alembert, they have players that they're giving a lot of money to, a lot of money for the minimum, you know, like a lot of guaranteed money to. And some of those players aren't going to make the team.
Yeah, we'll see how healthy JaVale is now. He still has would have had 1 year left on that huge four-year, $44 million contract he signed, but he obviously was let go by the Sixers after they took him into their cap space last year. This is the best situation that he's been in. We'll see how healthy he is. We'll see, you know, where he is from a mental perspective, but I can't think of a better chance for him to succeed than a Dallas team that really needs someone to protect the rim. And also that has a real good training staff and is a great coach. I mean, now it could be that Rick Carlisle will be so annoyed with him that he just never plays him and it doesn't mean anything that they signed him. But I think he has a chance to really rehabilitate his career here. A couple other things. Markieff Morris, we talked about him a couple episodes back. He actually said in an interview with Keith Pompey, who covers the Sixers, but Markieff is a Philly guy, that he doesn't expect to be in Phoenix. And then Pompey later reported that the plan is that he's just not going to talk to anyone in management. He's been ignoring his teammates. It's just going to be one-word answers to Coach Hornacek, and he's planning to get out of there. So we'll see whether that works or not. It'll be interesting to see what the Suns can get from him and how much of a game of chicken they're willing to play with him.
Never take a discount.
And finally, Joel Embiid did, in fact, have his surgery. The Sixers released a statement today saying that it was not a re-break. There just wasn't the level of healing that was anticipated. That's a little odd to me because why couldn't they just tell whether that healing had occurred before they let him resume basketball activities? Maybe it's just too difficult to figure it out without really kind of going in there, but he didn't re-break it. He did had a procedure done that is similar to what Kevin Durant done in the sense that he had a bone graft where they just took bone from his hip, put more bone in there to kind of fortify the joint. But the big difference between what he had done and what Durant had done is this is his navicular bone. And that's a much more fragile bone. Players have had much more difficulty coming back from that than Durant, which is your fifth metatarsal Jones fracture. So Durant is looking good again, obviously. I mean, this is it's good that Embiid had this surgery. They had a ton of specialists in. But to say that now he's going to be out of the woods, he had the same surgery as Durant, and that seems to have worked. They're still totally different injuries. It's just a similar procedure for the two different injuries that they suffered.
Yeah, and the navicular bone, as I understand it, one of the big issues with that is blood flow, right?
Right, yeah. I think and supposedly, the blood flow and the healing was a little bit better than they thought it would be, given where he was at when they knew that he needed to have the surgery again. But we'll see. I mean, obviously, you know, the road to discontent is paved with reports of successful surgeries. All right, let's get some questions.
Yeah.
You want to start us off?
Sure. So, question from Ethan Kearns. What do you think Ainge's next big trade will make for the Celtics, and then who wins the Jared Sullinger for, I presume, Markieff Morris trade?
That would be whoever gets Markieff Morris, correct. Obviously. I think Ainge's next trade, it's hard to know, really. obviously he's going to be trying to consolidate assets, either in the form of combining a bunch of draft picks to move up, as they tried to do to get Justice Winslow when the Hornets wouldn't bite and took Frank Kaminsky instead, or it's going to be to try and get some sort of a star. But with the amount of money around the league and the fact that there just aren't really any stars that you might look at as being discontented, and then would they even necessarily want to go to Boston? Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. I think the next move for Boston, as we've talked about on previous programs, to me is just try and be as good as you can this year. I think that they do have the potential if they play like they did second half of last year and their young guys can take another leap, particularly Smart. And now that they have Amir Johnson to protect the rim, I think that they could kind of get into that mix where they're in the 45 wins or so area. And then maybe they start to become a lot more attractive of a destination. But I don't think you can say much more than that about what their future plans are.
I have this suspicion that if the Nets pick ends up being very good, that they might try to move that for a more established player, which would be their next big move. But as you said, it's very unclear right now who that would be. The logical guy in some ways would be DeMarcus Cousins, but that would be a year from now, and who knows what the Kings will be doing at that point. But what makes his situation, the Celtics situation, so challenging is right now they have a lack of marquee assets. They have some interesting speculative assets that have gotten better with the Mavericks being disappointed in free agency and the Nets deciding to blow apart their chance of really being a playoff team next year. But at this point, in August, those are still unclear in terms of the value of those assets. So you want to do what Daryl Morey did with the Rockets and have enough powder ready and dry for when that discontent player comes and wait for another team to make a mistake. But you still have to have the most assets that you're willing to move at that point, and that's, I think, going to be the biggest problem for the Celtics rather than the supply issue.
Yeah, that's another thing, too. I mean, and I would say as well, maybe the strategy is just hold on to all those picks. They have so many that maybe you're just bound to get a star out of it. If you just draft enough times around number 15 or something, and then you've got the Dallas pick and you've got the Brooklyn pick in 2016 and 2018, that could be pretty good. And then the pick swap in 2017, and you just hold on to those and hope that you get a star out of one of those picks. I mean, they have so many. The odds, you wouldn't say they're in their favor, but they're higher than for a lot of other teams, even though their own pick is not going to be a top 10 pick probably in the next few years, it's looking like. All right, let's get on to the next one. This was an interesting one because I've been thinking about this too. This is from Daniil Loza. What is Toronto's long-term plan for team building? Carroll and Lowry are 29, and their only player with upside is Valanciunas.
There are two components of this. One is that they'll have cap space next season. We talked about that in our 2016 podcast, which I believe was last week. The other part is the Knicks pick, which so they have the rights from the Andrea Bargnani trade for the worst of the Nuggets pick and the Knicks pick. And that, by most expectations, will probably be in the, you know, the 10 to 12 range, maybe even a little bit better than that. And so that's a huge piece. I mean, that's not going to get you an all-star, but that could get you a starter. And so you can kind of build in two segments then, depending on how they use that cap space. They also have, I don't think Corey Joseph is going to be, you know, a solid, you know, a very good starter in the league, but he's a nice little piece. So I think that's where you start with it. And you can do what I would hope for them is that they do a two-tier build. So you have enough young guys that are close that you can be relevant, but you can also lose if you need to shed some of the other guys, and you can do that and then build around your young core, but you do it from a place of success rather than bottoming out.
If Valanciunas, we haven't talked about DeRozan either. He might have some more upside as well, as long if he can get a little bit better defensively and also just learn to shoot 3-pointers a little more. He is 25, so you wonder if that's ever going to happen for him, and he's obviously going to take a big raise because he's going to be able to opt out at the end of this year. But Valanciunas, if Valanciunas can get to where he's an above average defensive player, and again, I mean, he doesn't have any worse physical tools than like Andrew Bogut does, then all of a sudden he's like getting pretty close to being a big star. So it could happen for him. They got that Knicks pick. They've drafted, well, I mean, Caboclo probably doesn't look like he's on the path to really being like a star, you know, but he could end up being a starter for them down the road potentially. It is a very legitimate question though, because you're going to say, all right, how are these, is this really going to become a contender 55 win team? And maybe the path for that is that they can just be awesome offensively this year. If they're going to go this path with Jamari Carroll playing a lot of four, I think it's hard to see how, and also just because they've improved their perimeter defense a lot, I do think they're going to miss Amir Johnson. I would have rather just tried to pay him pretty close to what he got for the Celtics instead of picking up Joseph and Bismack Biyombo. But, and I mean, because he's really only has 1 year at $12 million that's left. So when you consider that, and they even could have given him 2 years at $12 million guaranteed for about what Joseph and Biyombo and maybe a couple of their other guys ended up getting and still had the same amount of cap space next year, I would have rather done that than got Joseph. I don't know how good he's going to be. He can defend, obviously, but it's a lot to pay for a guy who's a backup, especially when you just drafted DeLon Wright, who's kind of a similar player. So, yeah, I see where this question is coming from, but I think they at least have some possibilities if those guys like Valanciunas and DeRozan can improve, if they could maybe make a trade, sign another starter, a Batum type of guy, and then you just got to hope that Carroll and Kyle Lowry can hold on to their present levels of performance long enough for the young guys to kind of meet them. And then maybe you could see them becoming kind of a Hawks type of team from last year, ultimately, is it. But, you know, the odds of that are low, but the odds of pretty much any team becoming a contender are pretty low.
And if they can stay relevant, you know, in the mix for hosting a playoff series for a couple years, I think that's a pretty good success for any team, but especially for a team that isn't in a major market.
Yeah, and maybe they can get into 2017 free agency as well. They should have plenty of space, especially this Valanciunas contract. If that happens, that'll help them out as well. That's going to be a lot less than I would have projected. All right, this is an easy one from Wuhao Phelps. Can the Jazz increase Hayward's 16-17 and 17-18 salary to get him to opt into his player option? The reason that Mr. Phelps asked this is because Hayward can be a free agent in 2017. He has a player option for the 17-18 season. The problem there, though, and what he's talking about is renegotiating his salary up and then extending it, which we've talked about on previous podcasts. Unfortunately, they cannot do that with Hayward because it has to be a four-year contract, which this would be, but you cannot renegotiate it until the third-year anniversary of the signing of the contract. By that point, he basically will be a free agent. There's no reason for him to opt in at that point. If they're going to like him enough that they would renegotiate him up, why not just be a free agent and get five more years instead of three?
And a bigger raise.
Yes, that's right too. So there's really, while it might be a good idea, especially since they have all this cap space, it would not work in the instance of Hayward. All right.
Nothing I need to add. I'll go to the next one because it's for you. From Martin Wong, I know Danny is quite high on Clint Capella. I'll add is. While Nate, if I remember correctly, you weren't quite so excited. What do the two of you expect from him, both for the coming season and long term?
All right, well, I'll let you go first on this since you're a big fan of his.
Yeah, so I actually wrote, I was a part of a piece for Hardwood Paroxysm talking about Capella, and he isn't perfect. I think that I was really high on him in the draft just because I'm a sucker for big men who can protect the rim and rebound, because that's a combination I like. I think that if you have a guy who can do both of those at a high level, you can do pretty well. And notice that I'm using protect the rim rather than block shots, because I think those are different in a way that matters with Capella. He had a crazy small sample size last year, but he did very well in both of those things. I think that he can do that. I don't think that his offensive game is so limited. I don't think you want him to start, but fortunately he plays on a team that has no need for that. So I think he'll be productive in a small role. He's going to have to get a whole heck of a lot better to be a starter, but if he can get those key attributes to me to a baseline that I expect him to, he'll be a useful player in the league.
Yeah, I think he can be a backup. You know, he can be effective in the pick and roll, catching alley-oops. He He's pretty good switching out on guys too. Sort of this Dallas Mavericks, Brandon Wright type of guy. I think that's about his ceiling. I don't see him being a guy who's going to have a ton of shooting range. Certainly not something you're going to throw it to in the post. And probably, although he's got a little bit more heft than Wright does, and he's still, you know, he's really young too. He just finished his age 20 season. He's not someone who I think can hold up in the post against a lot of centers. So I see him as a high quality backup, maybe someone who could finish games for certain teams when there's not a huge power matchup against him. But ultimately, to me, my big problem with him is that he's, you know, power forward or center in a power forward's body. So I don't see him as a starter, but he did show me some things last year. And also his statistical translations were always great from Europe. So I think he could be a quality player and someone who will get a nice second contract, but maybe not a starter on a good team.
I think that's certainly fair. I'm a little bit higher, but I understand. I think that he can benefit from the lack of true back-to-the-basket centers. And there, you know, Okafor is coming into the league, but there aren't that many of those guys now. You see more of the, you know, the Karl Towns type. Well, Karl Towns obviously does have back-to-the-basket game, but I think that there are less people in the league now that will bully him than there would have been if he had come in 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. This one is from Colin Schmalager. Would you rather have Vucevic or Valanciunas? Let's assume the rumors are true for Jonas' contract. So I think that what Colin was saying here is on their current contracts, I still would much rather have Valanciunas. I don't think Vucevic has the physical tools defensively that Valanciunas could potentially have. And Valanciunas is quite a bit younger, so give me Valanciunas.
Yeah, and we just talked about it a little bit with Capella. For me, the priority for a big man, if you can protect the rim, not that either one of them is particularly strong in it, but Vucevic has a lot less potential and he has been worse defensively. And he has, you know, he could get better. He's young, he's a talented guy, but I see a little bit too much, let's say, Enes Kanter in him. But, you know, I think Valanciunas is the call, but I still have a little bit of faith that Vucevic can be better than he's been.
All right, this next one's a pretty easy one from Dimitri Samaras, I think is how you pronounce his last name. We apologize to everyone whose last names we are butchering here. Could or would a sign-and-trade involving Markieff Morris and Tristan Thompson work? Very unlikely, because Tristan Thompson wouldn't sign for anything low enough that could make those salaries match. Phoenix would have to throw in some more salary into that. But moreover, if you're Phoenix, I think you could probably actually do a little better than that when you consider that Thompson, you know, they already have Len, they already have Tyson Chandler. So again, Thompson, a guy who really has got to play center most of the time, he would not be a good fit there. And also getting him on that contract is not a great value. I would rather see what else I could get besides Markieff. So I don't see that one happening. So I think we can move on to the next one there, unless you disagree with me.
I don't. One other small thing I want to note here that doesn't come into play with this probably is that if theoretically a trade like that pushed Phoenix, if it were possible to structure it that way, in over the apron, because teams that are over the luxury tax apron cannot acquire players via sign-and-trade. So I just want to mention that because that's something people get confused on a lot.
Sometimes actually with the tax. If they're in the tax, they cannot. It's not over the apron. It's in the tax.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
But Cleveland can send away Thompson in a sign-and-trade.
Correct.
Can't get someone.
But that's a limitation in terms of teams like the Clippers and the Cavs that people don't always think about is, you know, when there are some limited avenues for them in terms of augmenting their existing talent.
Right. Now, a sign-and-trade, after it happens, hard caps you for the year.
Correct.
At the apron.
Correct.
But whether you can actually do the sign-and-trade or not right at that time is based on whether you are in the tax and or would be in the tax when you're
right,
done.
Exactly. Thank you for the clarification.
Martin Dixon Pedrice. Which power forward center combination would be an ideal starting front court for the Bulls, in your opinion? Assuming Noah and Gasol won't start together again, there's sort of been some talk out of that reporting from anonymous sources that that's not going to be the case, that they will not start together again. Thank God. I think it's very clearly Mirotić and Noah. Noah's been saying he feels much better. Of course, everyone says that during the summer. Derrick Rose also supposedly feels awesome. And his trainer had a lengthy interview saying how awesome he looked. Russ Westbrook said he looks back to the old Derrick Rose. Hopefully that's not the 2013-14 Derrick Rose, but the 2012 Derrick Rose that they're talking about. But anyway, I digress. I think that's clearly it. I think the pairings that really work are Gibson, Gasol, and Noah Mirotic. I like Gasol coming off the bench, being able to really use more energy, fight harder for deep post position, take advantage of backup bigs on the block, provide a source of offense for the second unit, and then whoever ends up closing really just depends what the matchups are and who's playing well that game. Although I do think Gibson and Mirotic could also get some real good minutes together when you're not playing against a huge center, and if Noah is, looking more like last year's Noah than 2 years ago Noah.
Would you say that if it were your decision, Mirotic would be the top man on their big man totem pole?
Yes, just because I think he's actually not that bad defensively, and just because of what he's able to do running the floor, he runs the floor way harder than any of those guys, and also just the effect that his spacing can have on everyone else in the offense. And he's also just a perfect fit for what Hoiberg is going to want to do, but we'll get to that in a later question.
Yes, we will. So the next question is, I actually don't have who the asker was. I can look it up quickly. But which general managers do you think have done the best, or teams do you think have done the best, worst jobs with their cap management over their careers, given the options they've had at the time? So, thinking about it more in terms of process than in terms of results.
Yeah, to me, the key is avoiding bad contracts. Now, you're not going to, based on this process versus results, things like Derrick Rose has been a horrible contract, right? He's been injured the entire time he's been making the max. But, at the time, it was a no-brainer to sign him to that max, so you can't go back and kill Chicago for that. I think actually Chicago, given the constraint that they have had with basically $20 million in dead money for much of the last few years, have actually done excellently. And I thought that Luol Deng trade was really a great trade for them to get out of the tax that year, to go underneath the salary cap and be able to sign both Mirotic and Gasol in one summer is pretty good. They draft well, so they're able to get guys in a value contract. Taj Gibson is another guy who I think is a value contract even now. So, and Noah has been a very good value contract as well when they got him under an extension up until last year when he was injured. So when you look at all that, I think although they've had a few missteps, generally the way they've managed the cap has been solid, especially since they had that fiasco of almost going over the hard cap in the 2012-13 season. But in an overall sense, I think they've done pretty well. Who else would you look at?
Is it cheating to say the Spurs?
No, because they probably had, from a cap management standpoint, if not the best, the second best offseason that I can ever recall, at least since I've been really following cap stuff closely.
Yeah, I think it's that. Also, Morey and the Rockets deserve a lot of credit because they've been able to maintain a shocking level of flexibility considering their team quality. You can think about these scenarios with them, of them being in contention for various players, despite them having the second best record in the West last year. So they're in that conversation as well. In terms of, there are lots of different ways. You talked about the bad contracts. Minnesota's one that comes to mind. The other one, and this is one you and I talked about a little bit on the 2016 podcast, is it is shocking to me how Orlando hasn't used their advantages at all.
Well, they have, in the sense that they have a lot of intriguing pieces now, but I agree that it was surprising how little space they are going to have for next year. Granted, they have young pieces at every position, so, but I mean, they did at least try to sign Paul Millsap to a max contract this year when they had the space, and they picked up guys like Fry and stuff like that, but I agree with you. I think anytime you have a bad team and you're still capped out, that is a very, very big sign of bad cap management. So, the Kings really were pretty close to capped out until they sold the farm to get some more space this year. And that was signings like the Landry contract, which made very little sense. Those sorts of signings not re-signing Isaiah Thomas, who could have been a starting point guard who was better than any of the guys that they had. Those sorts of things really, and then the Wolves as well, another team that has been really bad most seasons, granted in large part because of injuries for some of them. But, I mean, they had basically no cap space this year, and they had the worst record in the league last year. So when you're really bad and you don't have cap space, that means you're overpaying for a lot of guys, and that's never a good sign.
And I would give an honorable mention to teams in large markets that also aren't as good, that have a ton of bad money. And so for me, that's a team like the Knicks. That the Knicks have some huge advantages that other teams don't. They play in one of the most desirable locations, and yet they still have basically only that one offseason really ever used that to their advantage. And you can sacrifice that like Miami did to have a really good team, but when you do it for inferior products in a major market, you're really hurting yourself.
Another one I'd say has been really good is Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
Because even this year, they had space. It was just that their problem was that the guys that they signed were so good that they couldn't afford to bring them back in the case of Damari Carroll. But if you look at what they did in moving on from Joe Johnson and actually getting assets back for him, and then obtaining Kyle Korver for absolutely nothing, and then re-signing him to an incredibly reasonable contract the year after that, Millsap, they signed guys to short contracts that enabled them to keep a lot of flexibility going through their prime. Jeff Teague is another one. Even though they matched an offer sheet, they waited for the offer sheet from the Bucks. They didn't overpay, and then they just matched it. And, granted, his feathers were ruffled, but, now he really likes being in Atlanta under this new regime. So they just have a ton of great value contracts. Tabo Sefolosha, another guy who's probably a pretty good value contract. They haven't drafted as well, which has been a big problem for the organization. But what they've done from a cap perspective, Danny Ferry and now Wes Wilcox and Coach Bud has been very impressive.
One other quick one I'll add is that the reigning champions won the title without paying the luxury tax, despite having David Lee's albatross already on their books.
Yeah, and they were able to do that by with Draymond Green making the minimum, Harrison Barnes on a rookie deal, those sorts of, Festus Ezeli on a rookie deal, Steph Curry with the best non-rookie contract value in the whole league, making like $11 million. That's pretty impressive. The price of the bricks going up for them now, but they did a great job. And then Brooklyn and Detroit over the last few years have obviously been have also really just not gotten their money's worth at all either. We got to this one already on Thompson. Let's move on to this one. This is an interesting one. Andy Mullen. What would a fair over-under win total for Atlanta be this season, and what do you think their team-building strategy going forward should be, with Korver being hurt/aging and Horford likely leaving after this season? I disagree with that last part, that he's likely leaving, but go ahead, Danny. What's your thought on this one first?
Well, so I did a podcast with Arturo Goetti last year with over-unders, and the first question I always like to ask is, was their win total last year reflective of their talent? And I think it was a little bit higher. So, I don't think they were a 60-win
point differential
team.
Was about, indicative of like 55, 56 win team rather than a 60-win team.
So they have that, and they got better in a couple ways. They got worse with losing Damari Carroll and not replacing him with a guy who's nearly as good as Damari Carroll is, and that's a big problem. They also got older in a way that isn't useful for a team at their getting older for a team like Orlando is a good thing. Getting older for a team like Atlanta is a less good thing. And I like their big man depth now, but I think they're – if you put the over-under in the high 40s, I think they're probably going to win around 50, but that is a healthy 50. That doesn't mean, if Al Horford misses time, if Jeff Teague misses time, if Korver misses time. So you have to account for that, because if they put the line at 50, I'd bet the under if I bet on over-unders. But so, something in the 47 range I think would probably be fair.
Yeah, that's probably not what Hawks fans want to hear. I think between sort of the 47 to 52 range is about what I've had. And you make a great point about health. They were exceedingly healthy last year. All their starters played over 70 games, and a lot of those missed games that they had were due to just resting guys down the stretch. They don't like to play guys a lot of minutes. Korver, coming off that injury, is probably going to not play very much at all. He's going to be 34. Pretty much everyone on the team other than Teague and Schroeder projects to be worse this year based on what their ages are. So there's a hope that Schroeder can take a leap, but then same thing with Teague. Maybe you're going to play those guys together a little bit, and play Korver at the three. Cephalosha coming off another injury. He's 31. I know they really like him a lot, but when you consider that as well, and the fact that he in big minutes has struggled to not be an albatross offensively, when he was in Oklahoma City with a lot more one-on-one weapons around him than he'll have here. So yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons to worry. Tiago Splitter is also a health risk. I think he'll really help them on the boards and protecting the rim, and provides a pretty good one-on-one option to, I think that three-man, big-man rotation can be very, very effective. So they will be better in that respect, assuming he stays healthy. But yeah, I think you have to imagine there's going to be a big slide for them. For me, the big question is how well they're going to do at the start of this year, because if they're on pace to win 47 games, then maybe Andy is right. Like, maybe Horford could leave if it looks like this is not going to be plausibly a championship team. If you're kind of more in the mix, then maybe you can try to trade for someone who might be available on the wing, and they do have assets going forward. So including an extra draft pick from the Timberwolves, which is lottery protected from the Adrian Payne trade. So, maybe if it looks like it's not working, they kind of have to blow things up. I don't think that's what anybody wants to do, especially when you have a coach who is the chief decision maker, and when you have a new ownership and you have fans who saw a 60-win team and you're going to blow it up, less than 4 months into the next year. I highly doubt that they would have the stones to do that. And it might just be impossible to do that from a business perspective, especially because they're also trying to get a new arena now. So you consider all that, I think they probably are just going to continue going in with this core, and I would be shocked if they moved on from Horford, regardless of how they're doing next year. And I think Horford really likes it there. My guess would be he ends up staying, but it's definitely going to be white knuckle time to see what happens, especially if they disappoint this year.
One advantage that the Hawks have in his negotiation is that a lot of the best teams aren't going to have functional space for a guy like Horford, and a lot of the teams that will don't have a clear needed center. You could talk about a team like the Wizards, if they lose out on Durant, that they could, shuffle some pieces around and add him. Similar logic for the Bulls. Like, I think you could construct a case that the Bulls could have the money for him, but you're thinking more kind of on the periphery of that. And a lot of the best teams in the West aren't going to have space or aren't going to make those kinds of decisions.
Boston could maybe be a destination for him.
Better than Atlanta, really?
If
they hit on their
pick. I would expect, unless the Hawks can really get somebody else, I would expect Boston's future after this year to be brighter than Atlanta's. But the other thing that we're not talking about, though, that they can offer him is that fifth year. Because they're going to max, assuming that he gets maxed out, which he almost certainly will, his max will be $25 million at being age 30 at that point. Getting that fifth year, is anyone going to be paying him, $28 million or so on the end of that contract when he's 35, unless Atlanta is offering it? But then again, they've shown a reluctance to overpay well into the future. Maybe they don't even offer him that. That's another potential issue. So it's really his free agency and just how the Hawks do in general this year is something I'm going to be watching very closely.
Oh, I should add before we go on to the next question, the GM one that we got was from Stephen Stoops. Stephen Stoops, no, I believe. And that was a good question, so I wanted to mention that.
That was a good one.
You want to go to the next one?
Yeah, so this is from Yusing Chen. How much do you guys think RPM is a useful tool to either judging the players' play this year or going forward? Every year, most real superstars have a very high RPM, but a few role player guys pop up in there, say Cody Zeller last year.
I think that RPM does, it has a very noble aim and it tries to do a lot of things right. But what I always think about with it, and they try to adjust for this.
Well, here, why don't we say first, like, what RPM really purports to do. Basically, it measures someone's impact being on and off the court, adjusting for the impact of who they're playing with on their own team and then who's on the court for the other team. That's what it is trying to do.
Yeah, that's what it's trying to do. And for a lot of the time it works. It's hard in certain situations to apportion, let's say, credit and blame. And what I notice a lot is that the guys that it's the most off on, in my opinion, are players who get more credit for playing with a good unit that they're not necessarily making a whole lot better. The guy with this for me on last year is a guy like Zaza Pachulia. He's a great player, really good, not great. He's a very good player. He did a nice role on that Bucks team, but I think RPM had him in the top 20, and he's a good player. He was a part of that team, but those are the kinds of players it overrates, and like a lot of the on-off things, it underrates, and this is something I actually got into a little bit of a tiff with some people in my early days on Real GM about Kevin Durant with his plus-minus because he was a good player on a horrendous team. Oftentimes, those players get underrated by these sorts of things just because the context for them gets really murky because if a team gets blown out as much as those terrible Thunder teams do, it skews it to a point that you can't really salvage it.
Yeah, Anthony Davis is another example of that. Now, there are a number of issues in evaluating RPM. One is that it's a total black box. I have no idea what goes into it. I don't have the math skills to even evaluate it, probably even if I did know. But one thing that I have noticed, and Cody Zeller is a great example, is while it does purport to adjust for the quality of who's on the court with you, I think that guys who have really bad backups still seem to benefit a lot. Cody Zeller is one of those guys because Marvin Williams was so horrible defensively. Pretty much any other power forward that the Hornets had other than Al Jefferson was really bad defensively, so I think that makes him look like a better defensive player. I think that RPM is very useful, and also the ESPN version of RPM does, I think, include box score stats to some degree. We don't know what exactly because, again, it's kind of a black box. I find it useful to identify guys who I might be underrating, guys who are basically, it's sort of a preliminary step to say, all right, I'm going to go look at this guy a little bit more closely. And when you look at someone like Zeller, for example, he's, if you watch him on film, yeah, he's okay. But I mean, what exactly is he really doing that's so good from the four position? Is he blocking a lot of shots? Is he really just protecting the rim that well? Is he closing out so well? Is he stoning guys one-on-one? I didn't necessarily see all that for him. So there still has to be, in watching the film, you can say, okay, here's where this adds up to why they're better with him defensively, to why this guy's good. And I wasn't able necessarily to make that connection in watching someone like Zeller, and there are a lot of other guys like that. So when you see guys who are terrible by RPM and are good in traditional statistics or who you think are good, it makes you take another look. I think that it usually does pretty well. There's also a lot of sample size issues for 1 year RPM because, you know, you're going to play a lot with the same players and it's hard to kind of break that apart. I think that's called collinearity. So it's hard to break apart where one guy's effect ends and the other guy's begins. But I think it's a very useful tool, and we're much better off for having it than we were before we had on-off data and we were just relying on box score stats.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing I'd like to mention, you mentioned at the top and the bottom, that I always like to look at with something like RPM is, if you're looking at the extremes, what if these people is not like the others, and should I be thinking about that as well? So you talked about with Zeller. For me, that was, I had already watched it because I watched a lot of the Jazz last year, but it helped crystallize some of the Enes Kanter issues that I had. He's in the bottom 10 of defensive RPM in the entire league. And that's, you know, that adjusts for time. He's bad defensively. And so I think that in those circumstances, and then I think that it's a great way to think about, you know, to maybe look at things through a different lens. And it as you said, the most important part of all this is to take no single thing and have it be the end-all be-all and consider it for being a useful but, you know, flawed thing just like every other one is.
All right, we got time for two more. This is from Nico Machine, I think is how you pronounce it. Do you have an alternate pronunciation there for that guy's last name?
Machine?
All right, well, Nico, let us know which of us got your got your name right or whether it was neither of us. How do we expect the Bulls to play under new coach Hoiberg, and will the coaching change be enough to really help them challenge for a final spot, or should they have done more this offseason?
Well, I wish that they had gotten a better backup point guard. That is an issue when your point guard has durability issues. I'm being polite. But I think that one of the most important things that Hoiberg can do, you can talk more about style of play, is you and I have harped for the entire time that we've done this wonderful podcast about the frustrations with some of the rotations that Tom Thibodeau ran and the combinations of players that he used. And getting a new person in there who is less personally connected with some of the pieces involved makes it substantially more likely that he'll add the ingredients in better proportions. And so the, like, if you want to keep the food analogy going, that the food will taste better because he'll be using the ingredients in a better way, even if the ingredients are largely the same.
I agree with you on the backup point guard. They needed to do more than bring back Brooks. And I think they had the resources to do it. I didn't think there was any reason to pay Brooks more than what they could have as 120% of what he made last year. And they could have used the full mid-level, but the mini mid-level, taxpayer mid-level, to bring in someone along the lines of Jeremy Lin, although they probably didn't want to go past this year because they're trying to preserve space in 2016. I think that Hoiberg is going to emphasize pushing the ball in transition. That's something that this roster with Butler, Rose, and Mirotić is going to be very well equipped to do, and even Dunleavy runs the floor pretty well for his age or can spot up as well. He really likes to use a lot of drag screens, which, for those who don't know, that's basically just running a quick pick and roll at the top of the key while you're in transition. And, you know, a pick and pop with Mirotić, Rose pushing the ball up, they could get a lot out of that type of action early on. I thought that the biggest problem with their offense was just they didn't push it enough. And, you know, hopefully even Noah can be a little bit more healthy, and same with Gibson and same with Rose towards getting out in transition. So I think that when you say should they have done more, other than backup point guard, I'm not sure what else they were supposed to do. I mean, they brought back Butler. They brought back Dunleavy and did well to do so. He could potentially have had larger offers elsewhere if they let him get out of there, paying the tax now to keep those guys together. I mean, they even went into the tax further to bring back Brooks, even though I don't think that was a great use of that money. They at least spent it. So I think you can plausibly look at this team and say that there are guys with injury issues, but you could say, all right, Rose could be better next year. Noah can be healthy again. Gibson struggled with injuries. He could be healthy again. Mirotić could be a lot better. You can hopefully get the same out of Butler, maybe even a little more since he's such a hard worker. And, especially with if Noah can be better defensively, maybe you can get more defensively. And I think I've said before that based on what a lot of these individuals were able to do offensively last year, I thought the overall offense was disappointing. So I think they made the right decision. Bring in the coach, keep these guys together. I mean, what else were they supposed to do anyway? I'm not sure what else was really out there. And with all that being the case, see how it goes this year, and then they'll have a ton of flexibility in 2016 if they want to make some moves if it really isn't working out. But I thought the coach was enough of a change for this year.
And if the goal is, if we're talking about this in the lens of the conference finals, they have a very respectable shot at that, considering, I mean, if we pencil in the Cavs for one of those spots, which I think is more than fair, that it's a pretty wide open field because the Hawks should be worse both in terms of record and just in terms of playoff quality next year. And I have the Bulls as a playoff team, if they can be moderately healthy, I have them above the Raptors and the Wizards in a 7-game series. So they have a respectable shot at it. Miami would be tough, but what are the odds that Miami's actually healthy for the playoffs?
Yeah, I think I would still have them as the favorites to make the conference finals. So, I mean, whether you want to break that team up and do it for what? I mean, maybe you could say that they should have traded Gasol, and they have all this depth in the front court, but then you have injury questions with Gibson and Noah. So maybe you don't want to trade away Gasol, and then Gasol really, it's only worth trading him to another contender. So what are you going to get from another contender that's going to help you? I mean, presumably they would have traded him away for a wing. Oh, the other thing I forgot too is that maybe Snell and McDermott, they might get more out of those guys too. So that's another reason maybe for optimism. And I know management believes in those guys and felt like maybe Thibodeau didn't give them as much of a chance as they deserve. So that's another way that they could possibly be better this year as well. All right, you want to do the last one here?
Sure. Ryan DePauw asked one question that I think we both enjoyed a lot, which is players you suspect could make the leap next year, a la the aforementioned Jimmy Butler in 2014-15.
Well, first of all, making a leap like Jimmy Butler did, to my recollection, is just about unprecedented.
Yeah, that's a note I want to make, too.
So expecting that, especially from a guy who is that late in his career, at that age, who had been, frankly, a limited offensive player up until last year, as to become someone who suddenly is creating one-on-one quite a bit, becoming a 20-point scorer and, a really reliable three-point threat at the same time, I don't think that's just about unprecedented for a guy to come out of nowhere. And that's why I'm not going to predict anyone to do that this year, because it was impossible to predict that he was going to do that last year. So I think we're going to try and leave out guys who are in their second year, unless they're older guys. But with that caveat, we're kind of looking at someone who could ascend to all-star level, who is not really at that point right now.
You want to start with a couple?
Yeah, so here's some of the options that I looked at as I just kind of went through the rosters on this question. Dennis Schroeder is one, especially with the way he played earlier in the year. He's a lot of these guys that you'll see who are young can put up real good box score stats, which he did at one point, but then wasn't as good by kind of RPM metrics. As they kind of figure it out, their on-off impact can start to look better and be more commensurate with their box score statistics. So that's one, and I know the Hawks obviously really believe in him. I'm not quite sure what the next, other than just kind of cutting down on the turnovers and improving his jump shot, that's probably where the next step is for him. Mirotić is another guy. I think that he could be a guy who scores in the high teens this year if he plays enough and gets kind of close to all-star status. Reggie Jackson, who we both pilloried his contract, but he did play better with the Pistons. He's going to have a ton of opportunity in playing with a spread floor with Stan Van Gundy, having a great role man in Drummond. So although I thought that contract was a little ridiculous, it's also not totally out of the realm of possibility to me that he puts up some great superficial stats and could make the All-Star team, especially if the Pistons kind of ascend to playoff level and contention. So that's another one for me. I got a few more, but what do you have?
Well, I'll start with two guys that I was comically high on when they were drafted, and I've stayed on the entire time. And the first one is Andre Drummond, Reggie Jackson's teammate. I think that he's ready for that. Another guy who's put in a great situation to succeed. Now he'll be playing more with stretch bigs, which I think helps him offensively, and his defensive role can improve with Stan Van Gundy. And the other guy, the guy that I've caped forever, Rudy Gobert, he was great in the second half of last season, but if we're defining it as a player who can possibly make the jump to the All-Star, he has that potential. I'm not sure that he'll get there. The West is so stacked, but this could be the year where he goes from being a guy for people like me to talk about and how the Jazz have been my league pass team now for a little while to being somebody who is more in the more casual conversation.
Well, I think that guys who are more defensive players, it's really hard for them to get to that. And Gobert, I'm not sure how he gets much better, to be honest, unless he's going to be like, starting to score with his own individual offense. I'm not sure really how he's going to improve that much offensively.
Especially without a point guard.
Yeah, and then defensively, it's hard to imagine him being much better than he was last year, at least in the second half. So I think his big breakout was last year. I don't think that he has that much further to go already. And obviously he's an incredibly valuable player already. I don't mean to discount that. Another guy who I think we could see get to all-star level. I mean, I think Gordon Hayward and Derek Favors are both guys, although Hayward is probably, in the case of all these Jazz guys, it's going to be more that they're just getting more attention now if they start playing better, as opposed to that they really are that much better than they were last year, but their player development has been excellent. So that's another one that I could look at. I do think Drummond is probably the best candidate. I wish I had, I don't know why I didn't pick him. I think I just kind of glossed over Detroit or just zeroed in on Reggie Jackson because he has the physical tools. If he can become a good defender with what he does offensively and on the boards already, that's an all-star level player for sure. So, and I think people expect him to make that leap. He's got great coaching to do it. So if he just can get his head wrapped around defensively a little bit more, getting his body into position and rely on that a little bit more than just going for the shot block every time to just try to do a little bit more verticality, especially with his big body, you're not going to be able to go through him at all. I think that's probably the pick. Were there any others that came to mind for you?
Well, one that you put on your list that I'm incredibly jealous of is of Serge Ibaka. I mean, he's obviously a great player already, but I think that he has the potential to be... He's the only guy left on that Oklahoma City core that can really break out in that sense, and he's a wonderful player. And then the other guy who is on everybody's list, but he certainly could do it, he's on everybody's list for a reason, is Brad Beal.
Yeah, Beal, but again, Beal is probably a guy, at least in the popular perception, who is probably considered to be a little bit better than he is.
Right.
But yeah, I think if you're just talking about what he is and what he could get to, if he can just especially shoot more threes instead of more long twos and operate a little bit more in pick and roll. But yeah, Ibaka, to me, he's been working on his shot every year. It's gotten better and better. If he can become a guy who's not only just spotting up from three, but is actually taking threes out of pick and pop as well, and then, you know, obviously his defense, I think will just continue to be excellent. He's another guy who could really show up there for me, and especially if Billy Donovan is going to use him a little bit more creatively, and he can make those shots out of pick and pop, which with the footwork involved and the speed of the release is harder than it is simply spotting up. So it's adding a skill. Yeah, I think he could get there. And then a couple others, Tobias Harris and Eric Bledsoe were two others that I thought of potentially as well. But I think Drummond would probably be my number one.
Considering our sponsor's basketball reference page, I just also mentioned Giannis. He definitely has the chance. I think that it's harder for him
to... Yeah, that's a good one. His jumper that he's been reworking, maybe that'll all pay off for
and
him.
If a real offseason with Kidd, if you know, spending a year, if they have, it sounds like they're moving more away from the like point Giannis idea and moving him more into a big conversation, which is fascinating. And
that'd be great, yeah.
If they can go more that direction and they focus on using him that way, I think there's some real potential there, especially considering he keeps getting bigger for some reason. So there is that potential there with him to really do it. I think he's another year away from that if he ever does that, but there's the possibility with him this year.
Yeah, that's another good point. I'm really looking forward to watching him at Eurobasket, which we are going to have some podcasts on actual basketball coming up in about 2 weeks here. But yeah, all right, I think that will do it for today. Definitely check out SeatGeek if you haven't already. The code is CAPSPACE, all one word. You can also like my Facebook page. I probably will be doing some little tiny posts. I did one when the Valanciunas news came down, kind of just doing a spreadsheet of what their cap space might look like for 2016. So I haven't been writing, obviously. I'm doing my best to change that. We'll see what happens there. But in the meantime, for just kind of quick little ditties, that's a great place to get them when it's too long for Twitter, and also maybe a little more conversation or conversation among each other, as long as it remains civil, which I'm sure all of our listeners are. What do you got? You got anything to plug?
Yeah, a couple things. So NBA Utopia project still going on, getting some really good responses. You can send those. The first sporting news piece, you can either use the hashtag or you can do that. Also, this is the third podcast I'm doing today. I recorded one with Ben Golliver of Sports Illustrated about the Team USA, and then we went on to a lot of other stuff. And then I started the Real GM Radio division capsules. So that's going through one division, off-season review, season preview, and I did the Southeast Division with Robbie Callen and Mike Prada. So the two of them, it was a lot of fun. Those will be going up in the next couple days, and the capsules will be throughout the next 6 weeks is the idea, to get the divisions out before we really get into October.
Well, that's awesome, because we need more podcasts right now. I am dying. I've been driving all over the Bay Area for work, and I'm forced to listen to football podcasts, which has been a disaster, but I really need something. I'm glad that
you're too caught up on hardcore history. I mean, you'd have enough material there.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, yeah, so follow me on Twitter, NateDuncanNBA. Also, iTunes ratings, iTunes comments, all that really helps us keep this little project going as well. We're going to try and the plan is to keep it going throughout the regular season if we can get some sponsorships, and everyone's support has been great in helping us in that direction. So, and hopefully you guys are willing to deal with us shilling a little bit more than we had before, but I think it's a fair price to pay.
Yes, we appreciate you buying the things that we tell you to buy, starting with our great sponsor, SeatGeek.
All right, well, that'll do it for today. We will talk to you all next time.